Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. This week, Kieran Devaney has the remarkable story of the Brassbounders and David William Bone. Is there any hope of rescue for the Nervena, which languishes in a forlorn state in the Grand Canal Basin, stripped of many of its fixtures and fittings, alongside the Mary Stanford? Who cares for our maritime heritage, a listener asks. First this week on Seascapes, to an author, a keen sailor and a historian, his book, The State and the Sea Fisheries of the South and West Coasts of Ireland, 1922 to 1972, deals with the development of the Irish fishing industry from the foundation of the state in 1922 until the signing of the Treaty of Accession to the European Economic Community in 1972. He's based his research on official government documents, archival material from other European countries, as well as interviews with retired skippers, fish merchants, retired civil servants in Ireland and on the continent. Seascapes travelled to his home on Helvick Head in County Waterford to talk to author Sylvester O'Meary.
Yeah, well, since my early days and as a young lad here, I was watching the pier and going down to the pier with friends, and my father was in the lifeboat and he was a small boat fisherman, and then the others were sons of fishermen that were here, and we always were around the pier, you know. It's smaller now. At one stage, Helvick in the 1940s, just immediately after the war, was one of the top 11, it was 11th in Ireland, ahead of well-known ports that are much bigger now. Nowadays it's prawns mostly in the summertime. And in the winter time, the whitefish is reasonably good. And so they don't fish herrings here. The bigger boats fish herrings and they land in Dunmore East. I saw fishing in Europe and in Guilvinec and in San Nazaire and especially in Spain. And I used to go to Spain a lot. And in Vigo and La Coruña and those ports, because they were big participants here in fishing before the Second World War and immediately after it. And although they fished far offshore, they took a lot of fish from our continental shelf.
The East Coast before the war years dominated fishing with the herring and the herring fleets.
Yeah, the Irish Sea was a very strong herring area. They were mostly pelagic. Arklow is a very good example, which was a big pelagic port, both for mackerel and herring. They travelled even around to the west coast of Ireland and as far as north as Scotland, the Arklow boats. But it declined. The port declined in late 1930s, before the war. And after the war, they went away on trading boats and deep sea as sailors. And the port has declined totally now. They're only at Whelks now and a few things in the Irish Sea. Then Howth was a massive herring port. But the Irish Sea, with intensive fishing at the entrance, at the southern entrance and at the northern side by the Northern Ireland boats, herring shoals don't come into the Irish Sea like they used to. The biggest take of all of landings in Milford Haven was in 1946 and 1947. And the Milfords, they were steam trawlers. The British were steam trawlers. But the British fleet soon became not obsolete, but outdated. And they had to scrap a lot of the steam. And steam, diesel took over. And the Continentals were much better at the use of diesel. The Belgians, the Germans. The Spaniards came into it later, because the Spaniards were using vapor, as they call it, or steam, well into the late 50s and even into the early 60s. And the Pareja trawlers, they fished two boats throwing a big trawl. And the Continentals forged ahead of Britain, and Britain wasn't able to compete with them. Then the Continentals, the French especially, They were adept at the use of diesel, and they came to the south coast for prawns, and they went up the west coast, and they were in the Irish Sea. themselves and the Belgians were whitefish, a lot of concentrating on whitefish in Irish waters. The growth of the tenant farmer class in late 19th century Ireland and the prosperity of these people in the coastal areas too, they looked down on fish as a food and fishermen as people who worked. There was a perception, and it's mentioned by McLaughlin in his book Troubled Waters. He lays great emphasis on it, and it's true, that they considered the fish to be inferior and fishermen to be inferior. And with the result that investment in the new state, when Ireland took over, of course, the War of Independence and the disorder of the early 1920s didn't help prospects either. There was very little investment in fishing. And the banks and financial institutions didn't trust fishermen, didn't see fishing as a sound investment. And that didn't help either. The output is insufficient, even for the demand we have now, because the demand for fish as a food in Ireland has increased considerably. And we should have bigger quotas to supply our own market. But in the past, in the years that the Sea Fisheries Association was there before the founding of BIM, there was always a certain amount of imports coming into this country. And it was because there was an overemphasis on pelagic fishing, because herring were very plentiful at that time. And there wasn't sufficient place, flatfish especially, and we had to import them. And if you look in the book, I show that we were importing an awful lot of place from Holland. Yeah, well, I have great memories as a very young lad here in Helvik, and with some of the Kellys were with me, and I remember being on the row there one day, and we were watching two mines floating at the mouth of the harbour. One of them struck the black rock and exploded, and the other one went ashore and had to be removed by the defence forces. But the mines were a constant hazard, especially at night, you know, because herring were fished at night time. And you couldn't see if these mines were floating. And they were British mines, mostly. Now, the Germans did drop mines at the mouth of Cork Harbour and at the mouth of Waterford Harbour. But they were floating mines. And the Germans were also dropping mines into channels, magnetic mines in channels. And there's a photo in the book of one of them in the channel to Dungarvan in August 1940. But in 1941, they were flying Heinkels from Brittany at night time and dropping mines. But the big minefields were British. And then the big minefield was the whole way from Wexford to the old head of Kinsale. And then there was another minefield farther west, which was surprisingly near the Irish coast, near the galley, actually. And then it extended towards the fastnet and back along outside. And those minefields, according to documents in the British National Archives in Kew, were there, it said, to protect Ireland, in inverted commas. But they were really to protect the British convoys. And I have great memories of sometime 1943-44, I was very young, but my father took me up onto the head, I remember. And there were one of the Kelly's lads, Jamie Kelly was with me, actually. And my father knew the course watchers, and he asked them, let these little boys, could they look into this telescope? And I could see the British convoy, very big. There were up to 30 ships, one in a convoy. And actually, you could see the destroyers. If you kept looking for a minute or so, you could see the destroyer passing along the side, at the side, you know. But of course they were safe, because they went to East End, they cleared the Tusk, got into the Irish Sea, they were bound for Liverpool. Families from here were lost in the First World War at sea, and in the Second World War, Bill Nagel from up the road here, he was a fireman on one of those boats, and the boat went down with all hands. The mines came ashore as well and exploded and caused a lot of damage. They actually came, there were two mines came ashore east of the pier there in Helvik. And I remember one of them in the morning, it was a raining and easterly wind. And I remember the whole house shook and broke windows in this house and several houses along the road there. Well, the British had a participation actually up to 1926. They were patrolling the coast. And even later, an amusing fact is that when we our fishery protection vessel, the Murakhu, hadn't any live ammunition. And when we did get permission, because we were in the Commonwealth, to use a gun, we couldn't use live ammunition. We could only use a projectile that the gun fired. And we had to get permission from Britain to do so. Until 1949, we became a republic, and then we had certain more independence. We could act on our own, and so on. Castletown Bear and Dunmore East were smaller ports in those days. There were very few fishermen in Dunmore. Certain families, yes, but Castletown hadn't developed as a port. Even the participation in after the war and in the early 1950s, Biggs of Bantry had trawlers, and fairly big trawlers, and the famous O'Driscoll family, there are four or five brothers of them fishing, and Donal was one of the people who helped me with this book. And they were working actually for Biggs at the start, and there was Castletown was a small port. But during Lemass's time as Taoiseach, and I must say, politics apart, Lemass and Childers as a minister, Childers as Minister for Fisheries, and Lemass as Taoiseach, did a lot for the fishing industry. And it's disappointing and it's sad that the very same party gave away, I think in my estimation, they gave in too easily to Europe when they were negotiating.
We were exporting mackerel in barrels to the USA. And I mean, if you told a young fellow in school today that we were doing that, they'd find it hard to believe. But they were particularly plentiful then, weren't they?
Oh, they were. That's another story earlier, of course. It's the last years of British rule, because the mackerel industry was massive altogether. There was not a port along there of West Cork that they weren't curing. Of course, some of the curing methods weren't what they should have been. They were careless, and there was a lot of complaints came from America, but they tidied up their act afterwards. But then the Congested Districts Board brought instructors in on how to cure properly in the Donegal and the west of Ireland. But of course, we weren't in the congested district here, and mackerel fishing wasn't big in Waterford. But further west in Cork, Kerry, all along, even in Clare, which has very few harbours, and Galway, and in Donegal, of course. Donegal was more herring. And that industry, that was pelagic fishing, but it was seasonal. And these were part-time fishermen, a lot of them. And that was one of the drawbacks of Irish fishing too. I mean, you can't develop a fisheries properly on part-timers. And the number of part-timers in Ireland was actually 5 to 1, you know. The government in Ireland, in the 1950s, confused the development of the Gaeltachts with development of the fishing industry. They should have, in my estimation, that was a retrograde step, because Pat Conaghan, who's written a book on Donegal, he only recently, I was talking to him, and he said to me that in Donegal, when they brought one of these Gaeltacht ports up there, they couldn't find a qualified skipper who could speak Irish. Now, that kind of procedure certainly wasn't helpful to the fishing industry. I mean, if you're going to develop deep-sea fishing and build bigger boats, you shouldn't be looking for an Irish-speaking skipper, or you should. The two things don't gel, that in my estimation, anyway.
The voice there of Sylvester O'Meary, author of The State and the Sea Fisheries of the South and West Coasts of Ireland, 1922 to 1972. You can hear more on next week's edition of Seascapes, when we'll be hearing about our participation in the fishery talks and the signing of that agreement in 1971 prior to joining the European Economic Community. Next, to a note from one of our regular listeners who writes, "I enjoy listening to the podcast of your show each week. Just a comment regarding the Ice Tether Profiler Buoy. The Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution is, by the way, in Massachusetts, postal code abbreviation MA, not in Maine, whose postal code is ME. It's just a minor point, but I'm sure you'll enjoy similar confusion when Ireland adopts the 7-digit postal codes in the future. All the best from Stephen Storms, oceanographer and faithful RTE Radio podcast listener in MD, that's Maryland in the USA. Well, many thanks, Stephen. Much obliged, and apologies for that error. Harrowing to see the effects of the torrential rain, high tides and severe winds have had. In Cork, one would wonder about the fact that the River Lee has not been dredged in over 20 years, so that the level of the floodwaters when these extreme weather events occur are so catastrophic. In the 19th century, if your parents had the money, you could go to sea as a brass bander to train as an officer in the British Merchant Navy. Glasgow-born David William Bone was one of the last of the brass bounders. Kieran Devaney has the tale for Seascapes of the final leg of his 14,000-mile voyage on the barque, the City of Florence, from San Francisco around Cape Horn to Sligo in 1889, and a haunting link with one of the greatest disasters in maritime history.
My story starts here in the Market Arcade in South Great George's Street in Dublin, where my friend Mr. Stokes has a bookshop. And it's in Mr. Stokes' shop that I found a faded letter in a dusty book called The Brass Bounder.
I am very sorry that I have left your letter so long unreplied, but I've been busy with my writing. My ship in The Brass Bounder was the City of Florence, about 1,190 tons. If I remember right, she was on
The Brass Bounder, published in 1910 and written by David William Bone.
Spring in the air of it, a light, keen day, and the mist only strong enough to soften the bold, rugged outline of Knocknarea, our sailing mark, towering high and solitary above Sligo Harbour. The strong west wind that we'd fought and bested at the Stag's Turn friendly had blown us far on our voyage's end, and float our 20-foot draft in safety across the bar. At Rockley, our signal for a local pilot was loyally responded to. A ship of tonnage was clearly a rare sight in these parts, for the entire male population came off to see us safely in, to make a day of it. Old pilots and fishermen and gossoons, they swept up from creek and headland in their swift skiffs, and though only one was Trinity licensed for our draught of water, the rest remained to bear willing hands to the braces. Old Andy was the official pilot, a hardy old fisherman, weazened by years and the weather. He'd donned his best in honour of the occasion, a coarse suit quaintly cut, and an ancient top hat set at a rakish angle. Hasty rising showed him razor cuts on his hard blue jowl, and his untied shoes made clutter as he mounted the poop, waving a yellow, time-stained license. An odd figure for a master pilot, but he made a good impression on old Jock when he said simply,
"But bedad no, Captain. Sure I know hand of them big yard arms of yours, but I'll show you where the deep water is."
The ship steered to his liking, and all in trim he walked the poop, showing a great pride of his importance as a navigator of 20 feet. Suddenly, at no apparent call, he stepped to the side where his boat was towing.
"What? Ah, hold your whist. What are you shouting about? Ask the captain for a bit of baccy for the boys in the boat."
Joining the captain, he resumed his description of Sligo Port, apparently unheeding the old man's side order to the steward that sent a package of hard tobacco over the rail.
"And you lie at Ross's Point till you lighten up to 14 feet. What's the matter with ye now? By my soul. Salt beef and a few biscuits. Bad scram, yes, for ungrateful thieves."
We were homeward bound. The beef and biscuits go down. After that,
"You have a torn sail. Just a rag, do you mind, to make a jib for the old boat?"
It becomes quite exciting with old Andy abusing his boat's crew at every prompted request. We are beginning to wager on the nature of the next when sent to the stations for anchoring. Old Andy, with an indignant gesture and a shake of his fist, turns away to attend to his more legitimate business, and, at his direction, we anchor at seaward of the bar. The wind that has served us so well has died away in fair airs, leaving a long, glassy swell to score the placid surface of the bay and the pearly fringe on the distant shore. The tide moves steadily in the flood, broadening and ruffling eddies at the shoals of the bar. And when sail is furled and the yard and harbour trim, we have naught to do but reckon our wages and watch rising water lapping. From seaward there is little to be seen of the countryside. The land about is low to the coast, but far inland blue, mist-capped ranges stand bold and rugged against the clear northern sky. Beyond the bar the harbour lies bare of shipping, only a few fishing skips putting out under long sweeps, and the channel buoys bobbing and heaving on the long swell. A deserted port we are coming to after our long voyage from the west.
That'll be the Maid of the Moy, Captain,
said old Andy, squinting through the glasses at a smokestack on the far horizon. But high water at hand and no sign of wind, he takes the tug on a stiff figure, and we man the windlass, tramping the well-known round together for the last time.
Oh, the work was hard and the wages low.
Leave her, is the set shanty for the finish of a voyage, and we roar a lusty chorus.
Oh, leave her, Johnny, leave her.
A hard heave and the tug lying short. A Merseyman would have made the weight of the cable by this. Check and rally. Check. A mad rush round, the anchor dripping at the bows, and we move on across the eddies of the bar in the wake of the panting tug. A short tow for all the bargaining, and at Ross's Point we bring up to moorings, the voyage at an end. That'll do, you men, said the mate, when the last warp was turned. Pay off at the customs house at 12 tomorrow. That'll do. Few words and simple, but the meaning. Free at last, no man's servant. With a hurricane whoop, the crew rushed to quarters to sling their bags for the shore. 2 days later, on deck of the Glasgow boat, I gazed on my old ship for the last time. At the narrow bend, we teamed slow to steer cautiously past her. The harbour watch were there to give us a parting cheer, and old Jock from the poop waved a cheery response to my salute. Past her, we turned water again and sped on to sea. It was a day of mist and low clouds, and the weekly sun breaking through in a long, slanting cloud of light. Over the point, a beam was fleeting, playing on the housetops, shimmering in the window glasses, lighting on the water, on the tracery of spar and rigging, and showing golden on the red, rusty hull of the old bark, my home for so long, in fair weather and foul.
Johnny Lever, I guess it's time for us to go.
That's David Bone's story about the last leg of his voyage around Cape Horn to Sligo, written more than 100 years ago, in 1910. But what became of the bold young brass bounder? Here in South Great George's Street, Mr. Stokes will sell you a copy of the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. Inside the august volume, David Bone is credited with the saying, "I'm all right, Jack." And in later life, he certainly was all right. Where there was brass, there was money. David Bone went on to become Commodore of the Glasgow-based Anchor Line, and was knighted by the Queen before he died in 1959 at the age of 84. But there's a mystery which may never be solved. The talk was on the Glasgow Quays that he survived the sinking of a White Star liner. No record exists of him having been among the crew. Yet just weeks after his death, the Cunarder Alsatia on the North Atlantic run to New York diverted off her course in mid-Atlantic. And the officers and crew gathered on deck to scatter Commodore Sir David Bone's ashes above the wreck of the Titanic. A fitting memorial to one of the last of the brass bounders.
And it's time for us to leave her. Leave her, Johnny, leave her. Oh, leave her, Johnny, leave her. and the winds don't blow, and it's time for us to leave her.
Kieran Devaney reporting there for Seascapes on Glasgow-born David William Bone, a brass bounder. The narrator was Jamie Doran, and Brian Woods was the voice of Old Andy. Leave Her, Johnny, Leave Her was sung by Willie Murphy and Johnny Collins. Audio supervision was by Trevor Sweeney. A special word of thanks from Kieran to Charlie McCarthy from Dundalk for working out the sailing miles from San Francisco round Cape Horn to Sligo. International author Owen Colfer and distinguished composer Liam Bates will join forces to host a concert on the centenary of the feathered lifeboat disaster of 1914, which saw 9 crewmen of the RNLI vessel the Helen Blake lose their lives aiding the wrecked Norwegian schooner the Mexico off the coast of Wexford. The concert will be hosted by Wexford Sinfonia on Saturday, the 22nd of February, to honour and remember the crew members of the Mexico and the RNLI who lost their lives. The performance will include a specially commissioned piece by Liam Bates, Heroes of the Helen Blake. Next week here on Seascapes, we'll be hearing more from Silvestro Mwiri, author of The State and the Sea Fisheries of the South and West Coasts of Ireland, 1922 to 1972. Alwyn Gill has the latest from the islands. We'll hear about a northern sea route from Nadine through the Bering Strait to China. Also, a unique use for recycled flip-flops washing up on the shores of Kenya. All that and much more here on Seascapes. Until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.